Do you think that it's possible that people will wake up to the idea that there should be many approaches to this as the vaccines wane in efficacy and as people start to become more resistant to boosters? Then maybe they'll look at these things. Because what's confusing to people is that, well, if this is all some sort of a plot by the pharmaceutical companies to make exorbitant amounts of money, why aren't they trying to make exorbitant amounts of money off the monoclonal antibodies, which are also expensive?
I tell you, it's a great argument. We'll see, you know, molnupiravir, which is the Merck drug, which I think is going to be modestly effective. The registrational trials finally came in about a 30% effect size, so a little less than hydroxy or ivermectin. Ivermectin, as the oral drug, probably has the best efficacy of the three. And I think molnupiravir is going to be similar to favipiravir. We will have to see. But the point I'm making is that, listen, the monoclonal antibodies were before the vaccines. They're emergency use authorized. Yeah. They're more impressive results. You know, there's nothing to suggest that the vaccines can have anywhere near the treatment effect, because so many people who take the vaccines don't get COVID.
So many people who take the vaccines don't get COVID.
They never get COVID.
Right.
Not, you know, what does the VA data show you? 96% of people who take the vaccines never get COVID. So the vaccines are given to a large number of people who are never going to come in contact with it. With the vaccine. Remember the registrational trials?
Why would you say never? They just haven't. I mean, we're relatively new in this thing, right?
Well, the CDC tells us 146 million people have already had it.
Right.
Have already had it. Now, those data run in arrears. We could be closer to 200 million people who have already had it.
Do you think there's any reason for someone who's already had COVID to get vaccinated?
No, there's three studies well characterizing it, three more that have weighed in preprint, showing harm. So we've already covered the fact that recovered people don't get COVID a second time. And even if you argue that you think you can find a case here and there, boy, it's one in 7 billion people who can get COVID a second time. It's rare as hen's teeth if it even happens. So the point is, if you can't get it a second time, you can only be exposed to harms. So the vaccines, like any other medical treatment, are not free of adverse effects.
Now, what if someone got a very mild case of COVID, an asymptomatic test that showed up, or asymptomatic case that showed up as a PCR test, especially when they were running, what was it, like 40 cycles at one point in time? If that person tested positive on multiple occasions but does not show antibodies in an antibody test, do you think for that person it would be a good idea to get vaccinated?
You know, there's three ways to prove your immunity. One is you have a concrete case of COVID-19. So you have the characteristics, signs, and symptoms. You were sick, positive PCR test, preferably low cycle threshold, antigen test. I got COVID-19. I did the right thing. I was in FDA-approved research. I took hydroxychloroquine in FDA-approved research, and I tested positive for the PCR, but also the antigen. So I had, you know, COVID-19 is such an important diagnosis. Why don't we confirm it? In HIV, we always use confirmatory testing. We don't ride on one test alone. But in the case where it's well documented and you're sick, you're done. You basically have permanent immunity at that point. Now, over 135 studies support that now. Paul Alexander.
Permanent immunity.
Permanent. SARS-CoV-1, which is 90% similar to SARS-CoV-2, is forever.
So
it's forever.
If you have symptoms and you recover from those symptoms, likely you have lifetime immunity.
Everything we can tell, it's just like SARS-CoV-1. SARS-CoV-1 is 17 years old. It's one and done, supported by 135 studies. And this recent CDC, the CDC is a stakeholder in the vaccine program. They're running it with the FDA. They are. The CDC and FDA are the sponsors of the U.S. vaccine program. If they – and they've been telling – people recovered that they should take the vaccine because they could have it again. And that's the reason why when they were pressed to say, listen, find a case of someone who really had COVID-19 a second time, they couldn't find a case. That was the most revealing news that came out of the CDC in weeks. And it was great news for America.
So you think that recommendation is not based on science. It's based on the idea that they want to distribute as many vaccines as possible.
Well, it was based originally out of a concern of caution. Don't forget the vaccine recommendations.
Originally.
Yeah, originally. So listen, we're not sure if you can get it again. Take the vaccine, right? So they were just general. Remember, the vaccines originally were just offered, as they should. They're research. The vaccines are research. They are all investigational research. And so nobody can encourage somebody to take a vaccine, by the way. That violates the Nuremberg Code. Can't do it. Research is neutral. As a doctor, I can never tell somebody they should take the COVID-19 vaccine. Why? because same reason why I can't tell them, say, listen, you should be in my research study. You should take my research pill for diabetes. You know, if I told them that, you should be in my research study, I'd be sanctioned by the IRB. I'd be called by the FDA. That's out of bounds. We never give any pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal for participating in research. It violates the Nuremberg Code. And we certainly wouldn't do it with these vaccines because we don't have all the data yet.
So, but yet so many people are doing that.
Well, I tell you right now, they're walking a line on bioethics that they will be held accountable. You can't do that. You can't do that. No one can. No good doctor can. No good doctor. Now, getting back to vaccine safety. So the idea here is that we have to reconcile with vaccine safety. So the story is, by January 22nd, we already had 182 deaths after the vaccine. January 22nd. For all the vaccines combined, 278 million shots given each year in the United States, kids, adults, me and you, I took two last year, I took one this year, 270 million shots. The average number of deaths that would ever come into our central database, about 150. We've been keeping this database for 20 years. Suddenly, we are at 182. And then it was a very important recognition that many of us had. Say, wait a minute, the CDC and FDA, they didn't have any safety review. They didn't have an external critical event committee. They didn't have a data safety monitoring committee. And they didn't have a human ethics board assigned to the program. It turns out we had the wrong agencies leading the program. The FDA is supposed to be the drug watch government organization. They don't lead clinical programs. The CDC is supposed to be the outbreak evaluation program. They don't lead clinical programs. So, in fact, we actually had the wrong – we had the – in a sense, the fox guarding the chicken coop, in a sense, we had the wrong people leading the programs, and then we didn't have the independent safety committees. So there was nobody to stop the program in February. You know, normally what happens is you get five deaths after any product is unexplained. Black box warning. May cause death. You get to 50 deaths. I don't care if 50 million, 60 million people take the drug. You get to 50 deaths, it's off the market, and it gets reviewed for safety. I've been involved with these, Joe, at a national level. We never let a drug go on and be associated with 50 deaths afterwards. We were at 182, and there was no safety review. Remember, I told you in February, I demanded, as a citizen, I demanded a report from the federal government. We needed a report and a press briefing on vaccine safety and efficacy. We never got it.
Can I pause you for a second there? But isn't it rare that a group of people as large as the number of people that are getting vaccinated participates in some, what if you want to call it an experiment or whatever it is, but this is essentially a mass inoculation. It's extremely large number of human beings. So if you're getting 182 people
we had 182.
Shouldn't it be scalable?
We had 182 at 27 million shots. 182, 27 million shots.
Right.
Remember, the standard is 150 at 278 million shots.
Right.
So okay. 150 to 278, we had 182 to 27.
On normal conditions. But the idea was that people were dying from the pandemic and they were dying from COVID.
So here's the idea. And this is the best example. There was somebody in my circles around March. Came by my house. A guy like you, in shape, you know, came by biking. And his wife said, we took the vaccines. We took the vaccines. We're safe. I said, listen, I'm kind of concerned. By March, we're at 1,200 deaths, Joe. 1,200 deaths. I said, we're at 1,200 deaths. He goes, what are you talking about? We vaccinated 60 million people. 1,200 deaths, small price to pay. I continue the thought in my mind. Small price to pay for the Aryan race. That is the type of thinking that people comes into people's minds, driven out of fear, driven out of mass psychosis, that say, listen, I took the shot. I took a risk. If it kills somebody else, I don't care.
Well, there is a thing that people that took the shot and took the risk want other people to do the same.
That's exactly right. Now, fast forward where we are today. We're at 18,000 deaths.
And this is just the VAERS, which is underreported.
This is VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And we know in that system, these are certified by the CDC. So the red box report comes up once a week. It's certified by the CDC. That means all these events really happened because they come in as temporary VAERS numbers and then they vet them. So all of these really happened. 18,000 deaths. There are 30,000 individuals who are permanently disabled after the vaccine.
30,000.
250,000 emergency room visits, office visits, other healthcare encounters related to the vaccine. we have two separate analyses showing, one from McLachlan from Queen's University in London, one from Jessica Rose from Canada, showing that 50% of these deaths occur within 48 hours of the shot, that 80% of the deaths occur within a week. They're very tightly related. We now know that the spike protein, after these vaccines, is produced in the body for an uncontrolled quantity and an uncontrolled duration of time. And because the antibodies to the spike protein after the vaccine are so high compared to the respiratory infection, we now infer that, in fact, one gets a much larger dose of the spike protein after vaccination than the respiratory illness. And in some people, they invariably can't handle the spike protein exposure to the human body. Who dies? McLachlan looked at this and found that the vast majority of deaths are in seniors, the very people we wanted to protect. So the deaths are occurring in nursing home residents, people in their 80s, high 70s, and on down. McLachlan had 1,200 deaths at the time of the publication, took them and coded the deaths rigorously through the vignettes, independent reviewers, by causality. It was actually due to the vaccine. And they ascertained that 86% of the time, there was no other cause outside the vaccine, no other cause.
So
86%. Now,
how do they do that when you're dealing with someone who's that old?
Well, you have a vignette and you kind of read the vignette. There's been separately nursing home studies. There's one by Kirkendall and colleagues that in nursing homes, they had 100 deaths after the vaccine in a nursing home in Scandinavia. So they reviewed the deaths. They came up with a number closer to 40% were directly due to the vaccine. But what I'm saying is just like the respiratory infection takes out people who are teetering on the brink of survival. Right. The vaccine does the same thing because the vaccine and the respiratory illness are one and the same in terms of the spike protein. We're giving the body back the spike protein in relatively high quantities. And then a whole bunch of things have come out. So in VAERS, to make sure your audience has this down, 18,000 deaths. That's everything reported in. We know from a paper by Meisner and colleagues before COVID that about 86%, 85% of these reports are done by doctors, nurses, or other healthcare professionals. I think the vaccine caused the problem. And also the pharmaceutical manufacturers, only about 14, 15% are done by the patient themselves. We know from the data presented in the whistleblower, there's an FDA whistleblower lawsuit for deaths after the vaccine that was filed by attorney Tom Rentz using CMS data. So in CMS, we also know when they got the vaccine and who they died. And it doesn't depend on self-reporting, right? Because CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they know when people come off the rolls. And there, the underreporting number was established. So we know VAERS are underreported by about 4 to 5. So of those 18,000 deaths, 9,000 are domestic, 9,000 are ex-US, but they report through our systems. So if we have 9,000 Americans truly have died after the vaccine and the underreporting number is about 5, we're at 45,000 American lives lost, and that's what's in the FDA. That's the lawsuit against the FDA.
How do they arrive at that number of underreporting? There was a Harvard study that showed underreporting being as high as 1%.
Well, yeah. Well,
meaning what, they only report 1% of
right.
The
so the Harvard event. Study was the with the HPV or human papilloma virus vaccine.
That's all it was about?
Yeah. And the idea is, well, parents and kids are getting it and what have you.
Right.
So it's probably gross. There's probably gross underreporting there. COVID, people are on edge, right? And so what CMS, the CMS data, basically, you know when someone got the shot and you know when they died. And so we know what proportion of the U.S. population are CMS recipients. So by extrapolation, can calculate what the real number is. So the real number at the time they filed, the number was around about 45,000. Compared to what was in VAERS, that's how we can get to the underreporting relationship of 4 to 5. And we think that's a fair number. 4 to 5 is probably a fair number.
Now, what is the difference between the way the spike protein interacts with the body via infection from respiratory illness versus an injection from the vaccine?
Well, we learned July 29th, Bruce Patterson, who's a terrific molecular biologist, he's between Northwestern and Stanford, showed for the first time with a respiratory infection, the S1 segment of the spike protein is recoverable in human monocytes for up to 15 months after infection. So you had the infection, Joe, you got 15 months to clear that stuff out. Now, maybe sooner and hopefully lower exposure, you got monoclonal antibodies, other drugs, I got drugs, hopefully we had less exposure to it. we can, you know, our bodies can be free of the spike protein. The S1 segment's the outer segment. That's the one that actually docks with the ACE2 receptor. The S2 segment's the one closer to the ball of the virus. Now, I interviewed Bruce Patterson for the McCullough Report on America Out Loud Talk Radio, the McCullough Report. And what Bruce told me, and he had the data, is that in the vaccinated individuals, as long as he can see after vaccination, they have measurable spike protein, S1 and S2 segments, within the monocytes. We knew from a paper by Ogata and colleagues from Harvard showed that the free-floating spike protein was in the plasma for, on average, 2 weeks after the vaccines, messenger RNA vaccines. But one person in the study, it was measurable in plasma for 29 days. So that's spike proteinemia in the plasma. The spike protein damages cells. It goes, damages cells in the heart, the brain, damages blood vessels, causes blood clotting. We know the spike protein is dangerous. A paper by Ovolio shows it damages heart muscle cells, pericytes. The FDA has warnings on the vaccines for myocarditis or heart damage. So this is biologically cohesive that the vaccines could damage the human body and cause death. So the biological plausibility is there. We know that it's a strong signal, so we have that. We know that it's internally consistent in the VAERS system, meaning there are other non-fatal events like heart attacks, blood clots, myocarditis. And now it's externally consistent. The same pattern is seen in the yellow card system in the UK through the MHRA, and it's also seen in the UDRIS system in Europe. So what I've laid out for you is we've fulfilled what's called the Bradford Hill criteria for causality. That means it's it. I'm an epidemiologist by training. This is my line of work. I'm telling you, for a large number of individuals, the vaccine has caused death and these vaccine-induced organ injury syndromes.